This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy.
For most of the past 6 years, an almost daily ritual has been taking place at an Air Force base in Dover, Delaware, completely out of the view of the public eye. Cargo planes have been landing there, carrying the remains of military men and women killed in the line of duty.
As anybody who lived through the Vietnam War will remember, images of flag-draped coffins used to be a staple of wartime news. But in 1991, during the lead-up to the first Gulf War, then-Defense Secretary Dick Cheney banned the media from covering the return of fallen soldiers to Dover. And that ban stayed in place until February of this year, when current Defense Secretary Robert Gates made this announcement.
I have decided that the decision regarding media coverage of the dignified transfer process at Dover should be made by those most directly affected, on an individual basis by the families of the fallen. We ought not presume to make that decision in their place.
Not all military families welcomed the change, but many did. And among those was a woman out in Mountain View, California, named Karen Meredith.
I'm the mother of First Lieutenant Ken Ballard, who was killed in Iraq May 30th of 2004, which happened to be Memorial Day, kind of put a different spin on the day for me and for all of Ken's friends and family.
Karen had raised Ken as a single mom, and he enlisted in the Army right out of high school.
In May of 2003, he left for Iraq the day after Mother's Day. That was my Mother's Day present that year, and he promised me he'd make it up when he got home. But he was killed in May of 2004.
At the time, Karen already knew about the media ban at Dover. And so she asked for internal Army photos of his arrival there. The response she got, well, was a bit of a mind-bender.
They told me no. They said it was against regulations and it's for the privacy of the family. I said, well, I'm the mother and I want the pictures. And they said, it's against regulations.
Over the next 2 years, Karen got involved in the anti-war movement. But along the way, she also lobbied for lifting the ban on media coverage at Dover. I asked her why she felt so strongly that not only the families of fallen soldiers, but also the public at large, be able to see those images.
Because when Ken's unit left from Germany to go to Iraq, there was a big parade and there was much jubilation that we were sending these young men and women off to war. And there was much patriotism. And when he came home, there was nothing. And I don't believe that we need to hide them when they come back. They're coming back to the country that they served. And to bring them in with no recognition for their service is a disservice to them. In Canada, they have what's called the Highway of Heroes, and I believe it goes for 100 miles. But when a soldier lands at their mortuary and leaves to go home, citizens line the highway.
You know, Karen, we're professional historians, Ed, Peter, and myself, and we're always thinking about, well, where do things fit into the stream of history? Where do you think this incident of denying parents the photograph of their slain children, where do you think that is going to fit into the larger story of American history, Karen?
Well, as much as it's a black hole for all of us parents and family members, I've frequently said, where are the librarians? Where are the historians? Why is there no outcry from them to say, we have no history of this war in regards to our young men and women coming home. People in 50 years will look back and there will be no photographic documentation of this part of the war.
In an age in which photographs are more ubiquitous than
ever. Absolutely. You're right. This generation, there's millions of pictures.
Right.
And there's no pictures of my child. And that will forever be something that I have to carry. And it hasn't been easy for me. People have questioned my motives, and until they walk in my shoes, I don't think that they can question my motive, whether it was for political reasons or personal or both. I still wanted that picture. Ken loved being a soldier, and I should have been able to see it.
That's Karen Meredith. Her son, First Lieutenant Ken Ballard, was killed in Iraq 5 years ago on Memorial Day. He was 26 years old.
It's often been said that modern medicine, modern wars, really our whole modern way of life, have made death less and less visible, less a part of our daily lives. Now, a lot of people will say that the invisibility of the war dead in Iraq and Afghanistan is more of a political issue than a cultural one, and that may very well be the case. But even so, the result is the same, a world increasingly sanitized of death and dying.
And so for the rest of the hour today on the show, this is what we're going to be looking at. How have we, over the course of American history, learned to live with the dead, the war dead, but also with those who die ordinary deaths here at home? Is it true that we've lost touch with death, or has our relationship with it simply changed?
It's hard to think of a better place to ponder those sorts of questions than among the dead themselves. And so, on a rainy afternoon a few weeks ago, I headed up to a hillside overlooking the James River in the city I call home, Richmond, Virginia. It's the site of Hollywood Cemetery, opened back in 1849 and made famous a decade later when the remains of former President James Monroe were dug up in New York, shipped down to Richmond, and reburied there. A few years later, of course, the Civil War came, and with that war, Hollywood Cemetery became a busy place indeed. Many thousands of soldiers were brought from across the battlefields of the South to be buried there, along with 28 Confederate generals and later Jefferson Davis himself. My tour guide for the afternoon was local historian Hunter McGuire, Jr. We started at President's Circle, the spot where Monroe and his fellow Virginia-born President John Tyler are both buried.
So this is a pretty eminent spot here. And what would make this such prime real estate that two United States presidents would want to be buried here,
well,
to the extent that anybody wants to be buried?
The geography is what makes it outstanding. Let me say a word about the garden rural cemetery tradition. It began in Paris in a site of a monastery at Père Lachaise. In city cemeteries were getting overcrowded, so they decided to make a cemetery in suburbs of Paris.
And when was that?
That was in 1804.
Okay.
And to attract people, they went off to get celebrities. And they first dug up Molière and moved him there, and then Abelard and Heloise, they dug them up and brought them there. And with that, everybody sort of rushed in. People of Paris loved coming out and walking through these beautiful grounds. So people in Boston copied that with Mount Auburn Cemetery, which is another rural pastoral cemetery, beautiful one, but overlooking the city of Boston. That was, in fact, copied by Frederick Law Olmsted when he developed Central Park, because they then discovered that people in cities needed public walking spaces.
But the idea of a park in a city began with a cemetery. Wow. Okay.
And then up and down the East Coast, New York developed Woodlawn Cemetery and Philadelphia Laurel Hill Cemetery. And the architect of Laurel Hill came to Richmond and designed this cemetery.
And perhaps our listeners would be interested in just hearing. This is written on a tombstone. A little more explication than we're used to today. Endowed with extraordinary intellectual powers, he touched life at widely varying points. Scholar, soldier, orator, a commanding figure in industrial affairs, from prime of youth to the kindly winter of old age, he kept inviolate the chastity of a pure and stainless life. Peace well earned.
Wonderful. And that's one of the beauties of a garden pastoral cemetery of this era. In the Victorian times, people wrote beautiful epitaphs all over the place. Most of them beautiful. Sometimes they were a little bit snippy about their former wives, but for the most part, they're wonderfully romantic Victorian things.
Are there black people buried in Hollywood Cemetery?
Very few. I know of a few clergy and a few servants, but cemeteries tend to be segregated for the natural reason that people want to be buried with their families. And once family tradition start, people flock to be there.
So was this a cemetery for the well-to-do?
No, I think they were happy to sell lots to anyone who could pay for them. And that was not easy at first. And what really sort of turned it on was, well, President Monroe helped, but then when the Civil War came...
By dying. Yeah.
But when the Civil War came and this flood of casualties started coming in, then Hollywood really became popular, and there were people flooding in and out for funerals all the time, and lots of flowers and lots of flags.
Well, I think, in fact, I'd like to go over to the Confederate part of the cemetery, if we could, and talk about that a little bit.
The sun's kind of coming out.
So we're standing in front of a really important monument that signals, in some ways, the beginning of the Memorial Day movement after the American Civil War. If you can imagine a pyramid 90 feet tall, 45 feet wide, made of really rough-hewn granite from down along the James, brought here, stacked without mortar, 1869. All around this statue, this giant pyramid, are buried 18,000 Confederate veterans. That's because many of them died in Richmond because we were a giant hospital based here. And so others were shipped by railroad from the battlefields all across the state, where we saw about half the battles of the Civil War within 100 miles or so of here. So this was the best monument that they could think of to make with the materials at hand in the immediate wake of the war, when the city had been burned to the ground and was devastated. It's kind of a haunting place.
I thought early Memorial Day, and for many Memorial Days after that, really up until the World War I, Memorial Day would bring 5,000 people from Richmond out with their picnic lunches to listen to the bands play and to the oratory of Confederate veterans, some with empty sleeves and peg legs, but they all came out to celebrate. Some of them felt like it was the lost cause and they wanted people not to remember what they had sacrificed. And others felt like what they contributed to along with their northern brethren was the birth of a new nation that could win World War I and II and those sort of things. Memorial Day is a great event, whichever way you look at it.
That was Hunter McGuire Jr., a former board member at Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond, Virginia. He also happens to be the great-great-grandson of the surgeon who amputated the arm of General Stonewall Jackson.
Then pull off your coat and roll up your sleeve, for Richmond is a hard road to travel. Then pull off your coat and roll up your sleeve, for Richmond is a hard road to travel, I believe.
This is Backstory, the show that looks to the past to explain the America of today. I'm your 18th century host, Peter Onuf.
I'm your 19th century host, Ed Ayers.
And I'm your 20th century host, Brian Ballow. We're talking today about how political, social, and technological changes over the course of our history have shaped the way we remember the dead.
So here on Memorial Day, you think of places you go to celebrate Memorial Day. And if you think about it, there's really quite an array of different ways that we memorialize those who've given their lives for this country. And, you know, Peter, I wouldn't know, frankly, where to go if I wanted to memorialize the dead of the American Revolution.
Yeah, it's a great question. You wouldn't go to battlefields. You'd actually go to churchyards all over the country, particularly to colonial cities that have survived in the heart of the great modern American metropolises, and Old Trinity Church in New York and churches in Boston and Charleston. And in a way, those places would be, I think, where we would evoke the memory of the revolution. I think that's the way they function in American culture.
So when did one place that symbolized one war, when did that start? Must have been the 19th century.
Well, I think it's Gettysburg.
Uh-huh.
And what we sometimes forget is the Gettysburg Address was given at the inauguration of a national cemetery at Gettysburg, which was literally created in the immediate wake of the war. So what Lincoln was doing, think about this, the Gettysburg battle is in July. He's giving this talk in November. And when he came to Gettysburg, there were coffins stacked up at the train station. So I think that's the beginning of that. Now, it was building on the older ideas of, you know, park-like cemeteries.
Yeah,
but here they're making one on purpose, instantaneously, for massive numbers of bodies. And I think that lays the foundation for Arlington.
Yeah.
And the irony is that from that point on, up till today, our soldiers die elsewhere. So we almost have to have centralized places to commemorate this from then on, because our soldiers are dying in foreign lands.
Here's a quiz. Where do you guys think this first emerges? Where do we start seeing the first centralized monuments to sacrifice for the nation?
Civil War.
Nope. Even if you go to Gettysburg now, all the statues and monuments are state-based.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And they kind of vie with each other, you know, who has the bigger state monument. I never would have thought about this.
Yeah, I don't know.
War with Spain in 1898.
Okay. Perfect.
Right? Because
bingo.
There's a couple of things. One, the North and South are so happy to be fighting on the same side, right, that you can start to have these monuments. But also, in the meantime, you've had Franco-Prussian War and the emergence of these big nation states in Europe. And all the guys are putting up big monuments to the nations.
Plus, we kicked butt.
Exactly. And it was our time. So if you would look at the sort of proportion of the monuments to the actual war, Spanish-American is the biggest. And it turns out to be sort of a rehearsal, unfortunately, for the Great War that's to follow only 20 years later.
Do we have a monument for our invasion of Grenada? Because that would be the ultimate test. A gigantic, the largest monument for our smallest war.
That's an action item for our listeners. Brian, it's interesting if you think about the array of war memorials in Washington, D.C., that if you think about when they were built, you have the sort of a strange thing of the Vietnam War Memorial being built first, and then Korea, and then only most recently World War II. How do you explain that?
Well, I think this proves, Ed, that they don't teach enough history in high school. That's my first point.
It's postmodern chronology.
Chronology, right. Chronology matters. But
chronology is chronology.
A more serious answer, I think, is memorials represent what's going on at the time that these memorials are planned. And it often takes them decades to actually build and complete them. So I'm guessing that if the World War II Memorial was opened in 2004, I'm guessing it started maybe 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
And I associate that period in American history with a remilitarization of society, with Ronald Reagan increasing defense budgets, but more importantly, appealing to Americans' patriotic sense, a sense of self-sacrifice. And surely this is when the all-volunteer army was really beginning to take off in the United States.
Yeah.
I also would add that how could we possibly have a memorial to one of the nation's most unpopular wars, Vietnam, and not have one for perhaps the nation's most popular war, at least in retrospect, World War II?
And the great leveling thing about Vietnam, though, in the sense of making it a kind of good war in the sense that the people who gave their lives deserve to be memorialized and that we should never forget that, that really abstracts sacrifice from particular contexts. And that's a really a transcendent notion beyond time, beyond the occasion of war, beyond what the war was about.
No doubt.
For us to take a moment and reflect
and
on
didn't
sacrifice.
That happen in the Civil War, Ed? I mean, that abstraction, isn't that one of the things that helped bring together North and South eventually?
Yeah, in the early 20th century.
I know it took a lot of time.
And I think it's parallel to Vietnam in that there's a sense that why don't we memorialize World War II?
Right.
We memorialize it every day.
Because it was a good war.
Exactly, you know, and nobody questioned that. And so the Vietnam War Memorial comes along. It seems almost like an oxymoron at the time, you know, to memorialize something that a lot of people wanted to forget.
Yeah.
And I think that the Vietnam Memorial came, not only are we not going to forget it, but here are the individual young
people
who died.
We're not going to forget these individuals,
which
is why they're listed.
Exactly.
Whereas, you guys know, we've talked to World War II veterans. Their first reaction when you thank them for their service is, in essence, to say, gosh, I never even thought about it.
Right. We were all sacrificing.
We were all sacrificing. Whereas in Vietnam, by then, Americans were thinking very carefully about whether to make that sacrifice or not.
Robert Louis Gardner. Walter R. McCarthy, Jr. William Froude Train III. Don Joseph York. Joseph A. Goldberg. Harold Lee Guthrie.
That's tape from the Reading of the Names ceremony at the 20th anniversary of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in November 2002.
If hindsight is 20/20, then foresight can often be flat-out blind. Such was the case in the years, months, and weeks leading up to the American Civil War. One South Carolina senator was so confident that war would not break out that he promised to drink all the blood that might be shed as a result of secession.
4 years and more than 600,000 deaths later, that war finally came to an end. More Americans had been killed than died in all the nation's wars combined, from the Revolution to the early years of Vietnam. The dead amounted to 2% of the nation's population, the equivalent of 6 million people today. Last year, historian Drew Gilpin Faust published a devastating book about the consequences of all that dying, called This Republic of Suffering, Death in the American Civil War. She begins her book with that vignette about the South Carolina senator, and goes on to talk about how death on that scale not only created many of our modern funeral practices, but also altered fundamental notions about group and national identity. I recently had a chance to speak with her about her book. Drew, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you, Ed, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you talk about the idea of the good death, which is the way that people in mid-19th century America imagined the way that things were supposed to be. Could you tell us about that a little bit?
The idea of the good death was not a new one in the 19th century. There were books as early as the 1500s about good dying, holy dying, the good death. How to learn to die was something that you can find advice books about. By the 19th century, by the time of the early days of the war, this had evolved into a widely shared set of cultural assumptions that I found very similar north and south, across different religious denominations, and really across the United States as a whole. And what it consisted of by the mid-19th century was a set of precepts about what it took to die well. One precept was you needed to be ready to die and willing to die, because how you acted in your last moments would in many ways reflect what your afterlife might be like. And you prepared for that moment for your whole existence. Another aspect of the good death is that your good death was a witnessed death. It was a death among loved ones. It was a death at home. I think the Victorian domesticity of the 19th century had invaded this notion of the good death. And I'm sure you've seen many portraits or drawings of someone dying with all kinds of people standing around them.
Sure.
And that was so that your loved ones could be certain that you had died a good death, and therefore they would know they would be reunited with you in heaven. But also you could give them important last words, important messages as you parted from them.
It sounds like the Civil War was bound to have challenged all of those things where people died so often alone, so often instantly, so often without time for preparation. So I can see why the war would be a crisis in that notion of the good death.
That's absolutely right.
Could you have a good death on the battlefield?
I found many instances of soldiers trying to have good deaths on the battlefield, trying to replicate some of the precepts of the good death. One of the most striking and poignant was soldiers who surrounded themselves with photographs of their family as they were dying. That, to me, represented an effort to replicate the deathbed at home with a loved one standing around. Soldiers also talked about anticipating death the night before battles. They would write into their diaries or in letters to loved ones that they were ready, that they were prepared. And I also found many instances of military hospitals where soldiers turned to nurses or doctors to try to set up a version of the good death at home. And nurses and doctors were often willing participants, even to the point of, in the case of a delirious soldier, for example, letting him think that a nurse was his sister or his mother, because they too shared this common attitude about the importance of the good death and what a good death comprised.
Now, of course, only a very small portion of soldiers' bodies would have been shipped back home. So whose job was it to bury the Civil War soldiers on the battlefield?
One of the most extraordinary things I discovered, and maybe other people took it for granted, but I did not until I started this project, was that there was no formal identification procedure for soldiers. They didn't wear dog tags, and there was no formal notification of next of kin when soldiers were killed or wounded. this all happened more or less informally through your comrades writing to your wife or mother to say, I stood by so-and-so as he died, and this is how it happened. And often trying to communicate to the mother or the wife or the sister, whoever you were writing to, that this soldier had indeed died a good death, trying to put the circumstances of the soldier's death into the framework of the ideas of the good death. And so that was an important part of the whole communication system, this series of condolence letters that were really letters informing as much as consoling families.
Well, there must have been enormous numbers then of men who were just lost, that no one ever really knew when and where they died. And
probably about half of the Civil War dead, about half remained unidentified.
So how did the people back home live with that lack of knowledge?
I find that stunning. I've never been able, since I began doing the research on this book, to think about the late 19th century in the same way. Because if you do think about it in the context of this information, it means that the United States was a nation of mourners. It was a nation of people who were left with these incomplete stories about the lives of people who mattered enormously to them. And we have seen in our own lifetimes the strength of the MIA movement after Vietnam and the inability of individuals to grapple with not knowing, of not being able to find out information and even recover the bodies of their loved ones. But hundreds of thousands of families were in that situation after the Civil War.
Did they devise means to live with that lack of knowledge?
There were a number of ways that people tried to cope. One was religion and the consolation that eventually you would know what had happened to this person because you would be reunited with him in heaven. Another dimension of coping with this very difficult situation was the growth in interest in spiritualism, which said you didn't have to wait until an afterlife. Indeed, you could, under certain circumstances, actually communicate with the dead loved person. And he was not gone. He was just around a corner or behind a veil. So I think belief was a very important way of coping. I think another way of coping was memorials, and those memorials were often tangible, physical embodiments of memory that in many cases took the place of an actual body that you might be able to bury. Instead, you could erect a monument or in some other way have a physical remembrance of the person whose body you were unable to reclaim and inter.
Now, it strikes me that maybe by the 1880s and 1890s, people seem to have been forgetting how terrible the Civil War was, that the memorialization seems to take on more of an abstract quality and as people passed on. Did it seem to you that Americans sort of wanted to forget about the suffering of the war?
I think that was probably true. When I started my project, one of the questions that was foremost in my mind was, how is it that we have seen World War I as the turning point in the introduction of the real horror of modern warfare and mass loss into human existence? And yet if you go back and look at the Civil War, for the South certainly, where the loss was enormous because of the smaller scale of the Southern population and because so much of the war took place on Southern soil, and arguably for the United States as a whole, the Civil War should have been that moment of the horror of mass killing and the horror of such a level of loss. And so I've been puzzled by how, in many ways, this experience of war was something we shied away from, that we didn't entirely metabolize into our understanding of what it means to be human, of what it means to be able to kill others with the instruments of technology on a mass scale. And so questions, issues were raised by the Civil War, but they weren't fully engaged, I think, until we had another mass killing in the early years of the 20th century.
Well, thank you so much, Drew, for joining us and helping us understand this really intractable and yet enduring problem in human life. So thank you so very much.
Thanks, Ed.
Drew Goldman-Faust is the author of This Republic of Suffering, Death in the American Civil War. She's a professor of history and, in her spare time, also the president of Harvard University. We'll post an extended version of our interview at our website, backstoryradio.org.
I got to tell you guys that that interview has changed the way I think about what we've been saying about death. You know, a lot of what we've had to say is Americans deny it, we ignore it, we hide it. Mm-hmm. But half the people not identified and all those family amazing. Members for a lifetime living with that unresolved issue, that means they're living with death just about every day. And that really changes my conception of the 30 years after the Civil War.
But Brian, I'd suggest that the notion of the good death that Drew introduced early on is very important. And there's an element of denial in that notion of the good death.
Yeah.
And I think it culminates in reunion and reconciliation in the years after the war between Northerners and Southerners. And it does involve, I think, extraordinary denial, because what you're bringing to the fore is not the senseless slaughter,
right,
but rather the heroic lives of the brothers who destroyed each other and ravaged the land. And in a way, that's not the same thing as modern mass war.
Yeah, nor is building these stone monuments the same thing as standing around your relative's bed.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want to say that things are abstracted is somehow wrong. I don't know
live
with
it. It's a way of dealing. Yeah.
You know, the same way that individuals try to live with loss by letting it slowly fade away, I guess so do cultures, and ours is no exception.
Well, there's nothing abstract about my producer telling me we have to take a break. But don't go away. When we get back, we'll be hearing from some of you listeners.
If you'd like to be a caller on a future episode of Backstory, have a look at our website to see the topics we're working on. We're at backstoryradio.org. We'll be back in a minute.
I am deaf and I can't sell. I'll open the door to heaven or hell. Over till another year.